useless by scratching out a handful of connecting runes, then open the window and escape. I hurried back to the sitting room and snatched the letter opener off his desk, knocking over the capped inkwell in my hurry. I was just about to begin eliding runes when I realized how stupid that would be. Any petty thief could break into Ambrose's rooms, but the number of people who knew enough sigildry to foul a ward was much lower. I might as well sign my name on his window frame. I took a moment to collect my thoughts, then returned the letter opener to the desk and replaced the inkwell. I returned and examined the long brass strip more closely. Breaking something is simple. Understanding it is harder. This is doubly true when you're confronted with the sounds of muttered cursing from behind a door, accompanied by the clack and rattle of someone trying to unjam a lock. Then, the hallway went quiet, which was even more unnerving. I finally managed to puzzle out the sequence of wards as I heard several sets of footsteps in the hall. I broke my mind into three pieces and focused my alar as I pushed against the window. My hands and feet grew cold as I pulled heat from my body to counteract the ward, trying not to panic as I heard a loud thump as something heavy struck the door. The window swung open, and I scrambled backward over the sash and onto the roof as something struck the door again, and I heard the sharp crack of splintering wood. I still could have made it away safely, but when I set my right foot down on the roof, I felt a clay tile crack under my weight. As my foot slid, I grabbed the windowsill with both hands to steady myself. Then the wind gusted, catching the open window and flinging it toward my head. I brought up my arm to protect my face, and it struck my elbow instead, smashing one of the small panes of glass. The impact pushed me sideways onto my right foot, which slid the rest of the way out from underneath me. Then, since all my other options seemed to be exhausted, I decided it would be best if I fell off the roof. Acting on pure instinct, my hands scrabbled madly. I dislodged a few more clay tiles, then caught hold of the lip of the roof. My grip wasn't good, but it slowed and spun me so that I didn't land on my head or my back. Instead, I landed face down like a cat. Except, a cat's legs are all the same length. I landed on my hands and knees. My hands merely stung, but my knees striking the cobblestones hurt as badly as anything I'd ever felt in my entire young life. The pain was blinding, and I heard myself yelp like a dog that's been kicked. A second later, a hail of heavy red roofing tiles fell around me, most shattered on the cobblestones, but one clipped the back of my head, while another caught me square on the elbow, making my entire forearm go numb. I didn't spare it a moment's thought. A broken arm would heal, but expulsion from the university would last a lifetime. I pulled my hood up and forced myself to my feet, using one hand to make sure the hood of my cloak stayed in place. I staggered a few steps until I was under the eaves of the Golden Pony, out of sight of the upstairs window. Then I was running, running, running. Eventually, I made my careful limping way onto the rooftops and let myself into my room by the window. It was slow going, but I had little choice. I couldn't walk past everyone in the taproom, disheveled, limping, and generally looking as if I'd just fallen off a roof. Once I caught my breath and spent some time abusing myself for several types of blinding idiocy, I took stock of my wounds. The good news was that I hadn't broken either of my legs, but I had splendid bruises blooming just below each knee. The tile that had grazed my head had left a lump, but hadn't cut me. And while my elbow throbbed with a dull ache, my hand was no longer numb. There was a knock at the door. I froze for a moment, then drew the birch twig from my pocket, muttering a quick binding, and jerked it back and forth. I heard a startled noise from out in the hall, followed by Willem's low laugh. "That's not funny," I heard Sim say. "Let us in." I let them in. Simon sat on the edge of the bed, and Willem took the chair by the desk. I closed the door and sat on the other half of the bed. Even with all of us seated, the tiny room was crowded. We eyed each other soberly for a moment. Then Simon spoke up. "Apparently Ambrose startled a thief in his rooms tonight. Fellow jumped out a window rather than get caught." I gave a brief, humorless laugh. "Hardly. I was almost out when the window blew shut on me. I gestured awkwardly. Knocked me off the roof. Willem let out a relieved sigh.
I thought I had botched the binding.
I shook my head. I had plenty of warning. I just wasn't as careful as I should have been. Why was he back so early? Simon asked, looking at Willem. Did you hear anything when he came in?
It probably occurred to him that my handwriting is not especially feminine, Willem said.
He had wards on his windows, I said. Probably linked to a ring or something he carries with him. It must have tipped him off as soon as I opened the window.
Did you get it?
Willem asked. I shook my head. Simon craned his neck to get a better look at my arm. Are you okay? I followed his eyes, but didn't see anything. Then I tugged at my shirt and noticed that it was stuck to the back of my arm. With all my other pains, I hadn't noticed it. Moving gingerly, I pulled my shirt up over my head. The elbow of the shirt was torn and speckled with blood. I cursed bitterly. I only owned 4 shirts, and now this one was ruined. I tried to get a look at the injury and quickly realized that you couldn't get a look at the back of your own elbow, no matter how much you wanted to. Eventually, I held it up for Simmons' inspection.
It's not much, he said, holding his fingers a little more than 2 inches apart. There's only one cut and it's hardly bleeding. The rest of it's just scraped up. It looks like you scuffed it hard against something.
Clay tile from the roof fell on me, I said.
Lucky, Willem grunted. Who else could fall off a roof and end up with nothing more than a few scrapes?
I've got bruises on my knees the size of apples, I said. I'll be lucky if I can walk tomorrow. But deep down, I knew he was right. The clay tile that had landed on my elbow could easily have broken my arm. The broken edges of the clay tiles were sometimes sharp as knives, so if it had hit me differently, it could have cut me down to the bone. I hate clay roofing tiles.
Well, it could have been worse, Simon said briskly as he came to his feet.
Let's go to the Medica and get you patched up.
Cram, no, Willem said. He can't go to the Medica. They will be asking to see if anyone is hurt.
Simon sat down again. Of course, he said, sounding vaguely disgusted with himself. I knew that. He looked me over. At least you're not hurt anywhere that people can see. I looked at Willem. You have a problem with blood, don't you? His expression grew slightly offended.
I wouldn't say...
His eyes darted to my elbow, and his face grew a little pale despite his dark, sealed-ish complexion. His mouth made a thin line.
Yes.
Fair enough. I started to cut my ruined shirt into strips of cloth. Congratulations, Sim. You've been promoted to field medic. I opened a drawer and brought out hook needle and gut, iodine, and a small pot of goose grease. Sim looked at the needle, then back at me, eyes wide. I gave him my best smile. It's easy. I'll talk you through it. I sat on the floor with my arm over my head while Simon washed, stitched, and bandaged my elbow. He surprised me by being nowhere near as squeamish as I'd expected. His hands were more careful and confident than those of many students in the Medica who did this sort of thing all the time.
So, the three of us were here, playing breath all night?
Will asked, pointedly avoiding looking in my direction.
Sounds good, Sim said. Can we say I won?
No, I said. People must have seen Will at the pony. Lie, and they'll catch me for sure.
Oh, Sim said. What do we say then?
The truth. I pointed at Will. You were at the pony during the excitement, then came here to tell me about it. I nodded to the small table where a mass of gears, springs, and screws were spread in disarray. I showed you the harmony clock I found, and you both gave me advice on how to fix it. Sim seemed disappointed.
Not very exciting.
Simple lies are best, I said, getting to my feet. Thanks again, both of you. This could have gone terribly wrong without the two of you looking out for me. Sim got to his feet and opened the door. Will stood as well, but didn't turn to leave.
I heard a strange rumor the other night, he said.
Anything interesting? I asked. He nodded.
Very. I remember hearing that you were done antagonizing a certain powerful member of the nobility. I was surprised that you had finally decided to let sleeping dogs lie.
Come on, Will, Simmons said. Ambrose isn't sleeping. He's a dog with the froth that deserves to be put down.
He more resembles an angry bear, Willem said. One you seem determined to prod with a burning stick.
How can you say that? Sim said hotly. In 2 years as a scriv, has he ever called you anything other than a filthy shim? And what about that time he almost blinded me by mixing my salts? Quoth will be working the plumb bob out of his system for...
Will held up his hand and nodded to acknowledge Simmons' point.
I know this to be true, which is why I let myself be drawn into such foolishness. I merely wish to make a point.
He looked at me.
You realize you have gone well over the hill concerning this Denna girl, don't you?
Chapter 21. Piecework. The pain in my knees kept me from any sort of decent sleep that night. So when the sky outside my window started to show the first pale light of coming dawn, I gave up, got dressed, and made my slow, painful way to the outskirts of town, looking for willow bark to chew. Along the way, I discovered several new, exciting bruises I hadn't been aware of the night before. The walk was pure agony, but I was glad I was making it in the early morning dark when the streets were empty. There was bound to be a lot of talk about last night's excitement at the Golden Pony. If anyone saw me limping, it would be too easy for them to jump to the right conclusions. Luckily, the trip loosened the stiffness in my legs, and the willow bark took the edge off the pain. By the time the sun was fully up, I felt well enough to appear in public. So I headed to the fishery, hoping to get in a few hours of piecework before Adept Sympathy. I needed to start earning money for next term's tuition and Davy's loan, not to mention bandages and a new shirt. Jackson wasn't in the stocks when I arrived, but I recognized the student there. We had entered the university at the same time and bunked close to each other for a little while in the mews. I liked him. He wasn't one of the nobility who drifted blithely through the school, carried by his family's name and money. His parents were wool merchants, and he worked to pay his tuition.
"Basil," I said, "I thought you made a lear last term. What are you doing in the stocks?"
He flushed a little, looking embarrassed.
"Kilvin caught me adding water to acid."
I shook my head, giving a stern scowl.
"This is contrary to proper procedure, Elir Basil," I said, dropping my voice an octave. "An artificer must move with perfect care in all things."
Basil grinned. "You've got his accent." He opened the ledger book. "What can I get you?" "I'm not feeling up for anything more complicated than piecework right now," I said. "How about..." "Hold on," Basil interrupted, frowning down at the ledger book.
"What?"
He spun the ledger around to face me and pointed. "There's a note next to your name." I looked. Penciled in Kilvin's strangely childlike scrawl was, "No materials or tools to Rallar Quoth. Send him to me, Kilvin." Basil gave me a sympathetic look.
"It's acid to water," he joked gently.
"Did you forget too?"
"I wish I had," I said. "Then I'd know what was going on."
Basil looked around nervously, then leaned forward and spoke in a low voice.
"Listen, I saw that girl again."
I blinked at him stupidly.
"What?"
"The girl that came in here looking for you," he prompted. "The young one that was looking for the red-headed wizard who sold her a charm?" I closed my eyes and rubbed at my face.
"She came back? This is the last thing I need right now."
Basil shook his head.
"She didn't come in," he said. "At least, not that I know of. But I've seen her a couple times outside. She hangs around the courtyard."
He jerked his head toward the southern exit of the fishery.
"Did you tell anyone?"
I asked. Basil looked profoundly offended.
"I wouldn't do that to you," he said. "But she might have talked to someone else. You should really get rid of her. Kilvin will spit nails if he thinks you've been selling charms."
"I haven't been,"
I said. I've got no idea who she is. What does she look like?
Young, Basil said with a shrug. Not Sealedish. I think she had light hair. She wears a blue cloak with the hood up. I tried to walk over and talk to her, but she just ran away.
I rubbed my forehead.
Wonderful.
Basil shrugged sympathetically.
Just thought I'd warn you. If she actually comes in here and asks for you, I'll have to tell Kilvin.
He grimaced apologetically.
I'm sorry, but I'm in enough trouble as it is.
I understand, I said. Thanks for the warning. When I walked into the workshop, I was immediately struck by a strange quality of the light in the room. The first thing I did was look up, checking to see if Kilvin had added a new lamp to the array of glass spheres hanging up among the rafters. I hoped the change in light was due to a new lamp. Kilvin's mood was always foul when one of his lamps went unexpectedly dark. Scanning the rafters, I didn't see any dark lamps. It took me a long moment to realize the strange quality of the light was due to actual sunlight slanting in through the low windows on the eastern wall. Normally, I didn't come to work until later in the day. The workshop was almost eerily quiet this early in the morning. The huge room seemed hollow and lifeless, with only a handful of students working on projects. That, combined with the odd light and the unexpected summons from Kilvin, made me rather uneasy as I crossed the room heading toward Kilvin's office. Despite the early hour, a small forge in the corner of Kilvin's office was already well stoked. Heat billowed past me as I stood in the open doorway. It felt good after the early winter chill outside. Kilvin stood with his back to me, working the bellows with a relentless rhythm. I knocked loudly on the frame of the door to get his attention.
Master Kilvin? I just tried to check some materials out of stocks. Is anything the matter?
Kilvin glanced over in my direction.
Relarkov, I will be a moment. Come in.
I stepped into his office and swung the heavy door closed behind me. If I was in trouble, I'd rather not have anyone listening in. Kilvin continued to work the bellows for a long moment. It was only when he drew out a long tube that I realized it wasn't a forge he was firing. It was a small glasswork. Moving deftly, he drew out a blob of molten glass on the end of his tube, then proceeded to blow an increasingly large bubble of glass. After a minute, the glass lost its orange glow.
Bellows,
Kilvin said without looking at me, putting the tube back into the mouth of the glasswork. I scrambled to obey, working the bellows in a steady rhythm until the glass was glowing orange again. Kilvin motioned me to stop, pulled it out, and puffed at the tube for another long moment, spinning the glass until the bubble was large as a sweet melon. He set it back in the glasswork again, and I pumped the bellows without being asked. By the third time we repeated this, I was wringing with sweat. I wished I hadn't closed Kilvin's door, but I didn't want to leave the bellows for the time it would take for me to open it again. Kilvin didn't seem to notice the heat. The glass bubble grew large as my head, then big as a pumpkin. But the fifth time he drew it from the heat and began to blow, it sagged on the end of the tube, deflating and falling to the floor.
Kissed Kyle and coat!
He swore furiously. He threw down the metal tube where it rang sharply against the stone floor.
Crime it, Breviton Iron!
I fought down the sudden urge to laugh. My Ciaru wasn't perfect, but I was fairly certain Kilvin had said shit in God's beard. The bear-like master stood for a long moment looking down at the ruined glass on the floor. Then he let out a long, irritated breath through his nose, pulled off his goggles, and turned to look at me.
3 sets of synchronized bells, brass, he said without preamble. 1 tap and catch, iron. 4 heat funnels, iron. 6 siphons, tin. 22 panes of twice tough glass and other assorted piecework.
It was a list of all the work I had done this term in the fishery. Simple things I could finish and sell back to stocks for a quick profit. Kilvin looked at me with his dark eyes.
Does this work please you, Relarkvold?
The projects are easy enough, Master Kilvin, I said.
You are now a Relar, he said,
his voice heavy with reproach.
Are you content to coast idly, making toys for the lazy rich? He asked. Is that what you desire from your time in the fishery? Easy work?
I could feel the sweat beating up in my hair and running down my back. I'm somewhat leery of venturing off on my own, I said. You didn't particularly approve of the modifications I made to my hand lamp.
Those are coward's words, Kilvin said. You will never leave the house because you were scolded once?
He looked at me.
I ask you again. Bells? Castings? Does this work please you, Relarkwolf?
The thought of paying next term's tuition pleases me, Master Kilvin. Sweat was running down my face. I tried to wipe it away with my sleeve, but my shirt was already soaked through. I glanced at Kilvin's office door.
And the work itself? Kilvin prompted.
There was sweat beating on the dark skin of his forehead, but he didn't seem otherwise bothered by the heat. Truthfully, Master Kilvin? I asked, feeling a little lightheaded. He looked a bit offended.
I value truth in all things, Relarkwolf.
The truth is, I've made 8 deck lamps this last year, Master Kilvin. If I have to make another, I expect I might shit myself from pure boredom. Kilvin huffed something that could have been a laugh, then smiled widely at me.
Good. That is how a Relar should feel.
He pointed one thick finger at me.
You are clever, and you have good hands. I expect great things from you, not drudgery. Make something clever, and it will earn you more than a lamp. Certainly more than piecework. Leave that to the Ilir.
He gestured dismissively at the window that looked out over the workshop. I'll do my best, Master Kilvin, I said. My voice sounded strange to my own ears, distant and tinny. Do you mind if I open the door and get some fresh air in here? Kilvin grunted in agreement, and I took a step toward the door. But my legs felt loose, and my head spun. I staggered and almost fell headlong onto the floor, but I managed to catch the edge of the work table and merely went to my knees instead. When my bruised knees hit the stone floor, it was excruciating, but I didn't shout or cry out. In fact, the pain seemed to be coming from a long way off. I awoke, confused, with a mouth as dry as sawdust. My eyes were gummy, and my thoughts so sluggish, it took me a long moment to recognize the distinctive antiseptic tang in the air. That, combined with the fact that I was lying naked under a sheet, let me know I was in the Medica. I turned my head and saw short blonde hair and the dark physicker's uniform. I relaxed back onto the pillow.
Hello, Mola, I croaked.
She turned and gave me a serious look.
Quoth?
She said formally. How do you feel? Still bleary, I had to think about it.
Thick, I said. Then, thirsty.
Mola brought me a glass and helped me drink. It was sweet and gritty. It took me a long moment to finish it, but by the time I was done, I felt halfway human again.
What happened? I asked.
You fainted in the artificiary,
she said. Kilvin carried you over here himself. It was rather touching, actually. I had to shoo him away. I felt my entire body flush with shame at the thought of being carried through the streets of the university by the huge master. I must have looked like a rag doll in his arms.
I fainted?
Kilvin explained you were in a hot room, Mola said. And you'd sweat through your clothes. You were dripping wet. She gestured to where my shirt and pants lay wadded on the table.
Heat exhaustion? I said.
Mola held up a hand to quiet me.
That was my first diagnosis, she said. On further examination, I've decided you're actually suffering from an acute case of jumping out of a window last night.
She gave me a pointed look. I suddenly became self-conscious. Not of my near nakedness, but of the obvious injuries I'd received when I'd fallen off the roof of the Golden Pony.
I glanced at the door and was relieved to see it was closed. Mola stood watching me, her expression carefully blank.
"Has anyone else seen?" I asked.
Mola shook her head.
"We've been busy today."
I relaxed a bit.
"That's something, then."
Her expression was grim.
"This morning, Arwell gave orders to report any suspicious injuries. It's no secret why. Ambrose himself has offered a sizable reward to whoever helps him catch a thief who broke into his rooms and stole several valuables, including a ring his mother gave him on her deathbed."
"That bastard," I said hotly. "I didn't steal anything."
Mola raised an eyebrow. "As easy as that? No denial? No anything?"
I exhaled through my nose, trying to get my temper under control.
"I'm not going to insult your intelligence. It's pretty obvious I didn't fall down some stairs."
I took a deep breath.
"Look, Mola, if you tell anyone, they'll expel me. I didn't steal anything. I could have, but I didn't."
"Then why..." She hesitated, obviously uncomfortable.
"What were you doing?"
I sighed. "Would you believe I was doing a favor for a friend?" Mola gave me a shrewd look, her green eyes searching mine.
"Well, you do seem to be in the favor business lately."
"I... what?" I asked, my thoughts moving too sluggishly to follow what she was saying.
"The last time you were here, I treated you for burns and smoke inhalation after pulling Fella out of a fire."
"Oh," I said, "that's not really a favor. Anyone would have done that."
Mola gave me a searching look. "You really believe that, don't you?"
She shook her head a little, then picked up a hardback and made a few notes on it, no doubt filling out her treatment report.
"Well, I consider it a favor. Fella and I bunked together back when we were both new here. Despite what you think, it's not something a lot of people would have done."
There was a knock and Sim's voice came from the hallway. "Can we come in?" Without waiting for an answer, he opened the door and led an uncomfortable-looking Willem into the room. "We heard..." Sim paused and turned to look at Mola.
"He's going to be okay, right?"
"He'll be fine," Mola said, "provided his temperature levels out." She picked up a key gauge and stuck it in my mouth.
"I know this will be hard for you, but try to keep your mouth shut for a minute."
"In that case," Simon said with a grin, "we heard Kilvin took you somewhere private and showed you something that made you faint like a little sissy girl." I scowled at him, but kept my mouth shut. Mola turned back to Will and Sim.
"His legs are going to hurt for a while, but there's no permanent damage. His elbow should be fine, too, though the stitching's a mess. What the hell were you guys doing in Ambrose's rooms anyway?"
Willem simply looked at her, characteristically dark-eyed and stoic. "No such luck with Sim. Quoth needed to get a ring for his lady love," he chirped cheerfully. Mola turned to look at me, her expression furious.
"You have a hell of a lot of nerve to lie right to my face," she said, her eyes flat and angry as a cat's. "Thank goodness you didn't want to insult my intelligence or anything."
I took a deep breath and reached up to take the key gauge out of my mouth.
"God damn it, Sim," I said crossly. "Someday I'm going to teach you to lie."
Sim looked back and forth between the two of us, flushed with panic and embarrassment.
"Quoth has a thing for a girl over the river," he said defensively.
"Ambrose took a ring of hers and won't give it back. We just..."
Mola cut him off with a sharp gesture. "Why didn't you just tell me that?" she demanded of me, irritated. "Everyone knows what Ambrose is like with women."
"That's why I didn't tell you," I said. "It sounded like a very convenient lie. There's also the fact that it's not one whit of your goddamn business."
Her expression hardened.
"You come off pretty high and mighty for..."
"Stop! Just stop!" Willem said,
startling both of us out of our argument. He turned to Mola.
"When Kvoth came here unconscious, what did you do first?"
"I checked his pupils for signs of head trauma," Mola said automatically. "What the hell does that have to do with anything?"
Willem gestured in my direction.
"Look at his eyes now."
Mola looked at me. "They're dark," she said, sounding surprised. "Dark green, like a pine bough."
Will continued. "Don't argue with him when his eyes go dark like that. No good comes of it."
"It's like the noise a rattlesnake makes," Sim said.
"More like hackles on a dog," Willem corrected. "It shows when he's ready to bite."
"All of you can go straight to hell," I said. "Or you can give me a mirror so I can see what you're talking about. I don't care which."
Will ignored me. "Our little Quoth has a flesh pan temper, but once he's had a minute to cool down, he will realize the truth."
Willem gave me a pointed look.
"He's not upset because you didn't trust him, or that you tricked Sim. He's upset because you found out what asinine lengths he is willing to go to in order to impress a woman."
He looked at me.
"Is asinine the right word?"
I took a deep breath and let it out.
"Pretty much," I admitted. "I chose it because it sounded like ass," Will said.
"I knew you two had to be involved," Mola said with a hint of apology in her voice. "Honestly, the three of you are thick as thieves, and I do mean that in all its various clever implications." She walked around the side of the bed and looked critically at my wounded elbow. "Which one of you stitched him up?"
"Me,"
Sim grimaced. "I know I made a mess of it."
"Mess would be generous," Mola said, looking it over critically. "It looks like you were trying to stitch your name onto him and kept misspelling it."
"I think he did quite well," Will said, meeting her eye, "considering his lack of training and the fact that he was helping a friend under less than ideal circumstances."
Mola flushed.
"I didn't mean it like that," she said quickly. "Working here, it's easy to forget that not everyone..."
She turned to Sim.
"I'm sorry."
Sim ran his hand through his sandy hair. "I suppose you could make it up to me sometime," he said, grinning boyishly. "Like, maybe tomorrow afternoon, when you let me buy you lunch?"
He looked at her hopefully.
Mola rolled her eyes and sighed, somewhere between amusement and exasperation.
"Fine. My work here is done," Will said gravely. "I'm leaving. I hate this place."
"Thanks, Will," I said. He gave a perfunctory wave over one shoulder and closed the door behind him. Mola agreed to leave mention of my suspicious injuries off her report and stuck to her original diagnosis of heat exhaustion. She also cut away Sim's stitches, then re-cleaned, re-sewed, and re-bandaged my arm. Not a pleasant experience, but I knew it would heal more quickly under her experienced care. In closing, she advised me to drink more water, get some sleep, and suggested that in the future I refrain from strenuous physical activity in a hot room the day after falling off a roof.
Chapter 22. Slipping. Up until this point in the term, Elxadal had been teaching us theory and adept sympathy. How much light could be produced from 10 thoms of continuous heat using iron, using basalt, using human flesh? We memorized tables of figures and learned how to calculate escalating squares, angular momentum, and compounded degradations. Simply said, it was mind-numbing. Don't get me wrong, I knew it was essential information. Bindings of the sort we'd shown Denna were simple, but when things grew complicated, a skilled sympathist needed to do some fairly tricky calculations. In terms of energy, there isn't much difference between lighting a candle and melting it into a puddle of tallow. The only difference is one of focus and control. When the candle is sitting in front of you, these things are easy. You simply stare at the wick and stop pouring in heat when you see the first flicker of flame. But if the candle is a quarter mile away, or in a different room, focus and control are exponentially more difficult to maintain. And there are worse things than melted candles waiting for a careless sympathist. The question Denna had asked in the Aeolian was all important. Where does the extra energy go? As Will had explained, some went into the air, some went into the linked items, and the rest went into the sympathist's body. The technical term for it was thaumic overfill, but even Elks Adal tended to refer to it as slippage. Every year or so, some careless sympathist with a strong alar channeled enough heat through a bad link to spike his body temperature and drive himself fever mad. Dahl told us of one extreme case where a student managed to cook himself from the inside out. I mentioned the last of Manette the day after Dahl shared the story with our class. I expected him to join me in some healthy scoffing, but it turned out Manette had actually been a student back when it had happened.
"Smelled like pork," Manette said grimly. "Damnedest thing. Felt bad for him, of course, but you can only feel so much pity for an idiot. A little slippage here and there you hardly notice, but he must have slipped 200,000 thoms inside 2 seconds."
Manette shook his head, not looking up from the piece of tin he was engraving.
"Whole wing of mains reeked. Nobody could use those rooms for a year."
I stared at him.
"Thermal slippage is fairly common, though," Manette continued. "Now kinetic slippage..."
He raised his eyebrows appreciatively.
20 years back, some damn fool Elthe got drunk and tried to lift a manure cart under the roof of the master's hall on a bet. Tore his own arm off at the shoulder."
Manette bent back over his piece of tin, engraving a careful rune.
"Takes a special kind of stupid to do something like that."
The next day, I was especially attentive to what Dahl had to say. He drilled us mercilessly. Calculations for enthalpy. Charts showing distance of decay. Equations that describe the entropic curves a skilled sympathist needs to understand on an almost instinctive level. But Dahl was no fool. So before we grew bored and sloppy, he turned it into a competition. He made us draw heat from odd sources, from red-hot irons, from blocks of ice, from our own blood. Lighting candles in distant rooms was the easiest of it. Lighting one of a dozen identical candles was harder. Lighting a candle you'd never actually seen in an unknown location, it was like juggling in the dark. There were contests of precision, contests of finesse, contests of focus and control. After 2 span, I was the highest-ranked student in our class of 23 Relar. Fenton nipped at my heels in 2nd place. As luck would have it, the day after my assault on Ambrose's rooms was the same day we began dueling in adept sympathy. Dueling required all the subtlety and control of our previous competitions, with the added challenge of having another student actively opposing your Relar. So, despite my recent trip to the Medica for heat exhaustion, I melted a hole through a block of ice in a distant room. Despite 2 nights of scant sleep, I raised the temperature of a pint of mercury exactly 10 degrees. Despite my throbbing bruises and the stinging itch of my bandaged arm, I tore the king of spades in half while leaving the other cards in the deck untouched. All of these things I did in less than 2 minutes, despite the fact that Fenton set the whole of his alar to oppose me. It is not for nothing that they came to call me Quoth the Arcane. My alar was like a blade of Ramsden's steel.
"It's rather impressive," Dahl said to me after class. "It's been years since I've had a student go undefeated for so long. Will anyone even bet against you anymore?"
I shook my head.
"That dried up a long time ago." "The price of fame," Dahl smiled, then looked a little more serious. "I wanted to warn you before I announce it to the class. Next span, I'll probably start setting students against you in pairs."
"I'll have to go against Fenton and Bray at the same time?" I asked.
Dahl shook his head. "We'll start with the 2 lowest-ranked duelists. It will be a nice lead-in to the teamwork exercises we'll be doing later in the term."
He smiled.
"And it will keep you from growing complacent."
Dahl gave me a sharp look, his smile fading.
"Are you all right?"
"Just a chill," I said unconvincingly as I shivered. "Could we go stand by the brazier?" I stood as close as I could without pressing myself against the hot metal, spreading my hands over the glimmering bowl of hot coals. After a moment, the chill passed, and I noticed Dahl looking at me curiously. "I ended up in the Medica with a bit of heat exhaustion earlier today," I admitted.
My body's just a bit confused. I'm fine now. He frowned.
You shouldn't come to class if you aren't feeling well, he said. And you certainly shouldn't be dueling. Sympathy of this sort stresses the body and mind. You shouldn't risk compounding that with an illness.
I felt fine when I came to class, I lied. My body's just reminding me I owed a good night's sleep.
See that you give it one, he said sternly, spreading his own hands to the fire. If you drive yourself too hard, you'll pay for it later. You've been looking a little ragged lately. Ragged isn't the right word, really.
Weary? I guessed.
Yes. Weary.
He eyed me speculatively, smoothing his beard with a hand.
You have a gift for words. It's one of the reasons you ended up with Elodin, I expect.
I didn't say anything to that. I must have said it quite loudly, too, because Dahl gave me a curious look.
How are your studies progressing with Elodin? He asked casually.
Well enough, I hedged. He looked at me.
Not as well as I might hope, I admitted.
Studying with Master Elodin isn't what I expected.
Dahl nodded. He can be difficult.
A question sprang up in me. Do you know any names, Master Dahl? He nodded solemnly. What are they? I pressed.
He stiffened slightly, then relaxed as he turned his hands back and forth over the fire.
That isn't really a polite question, he said gently.
Well, not impolite. It's just the sort of question you don't ask. Like asking a man how often he makes love to his wife.
I'm sorry.
No need to be, he said. There's no reason for you to know. It's a holdover from older times, I think. Back when we had more to fear from our fellow Arcanists. If you knew what names your enemy knew, you could guess his strengths, his weaknesses.
We were both silent for a moment, warming ourselves by the coals.
Fire, he said after a long moment. I know the name of Fire, and one other.
Only two? I blurted without thinking.
And how many do you know?
He mocked me gently.
Yes, only two. But two is a great number of names to know these days. Elodin says it was different long ago.
How many does Elodin know?
Even if I knew, it would be exceptionally bad form for me to tell you that, he said with a hint of disapproval. But it's safe to say he knows a few.
Could you show me something with the name of Fire? I asked. If that's not inappropriate.
Dahl hesitated for a moment, then smiled.
He looked intently into the brazier between us, closed his eyes, then gestured to the unlit brazier across the room.
Fire.
He spoke the word like a commandment, and the distant brazier roared up in a pillar of flame.
Fire?
I said, puzzled.
That's it? The name of Fire is Fire?
Alxadal smiled and shook his head.
That's not what I actually said. Some part of you just filled in a familiar word.
My sleeping mind translated it?
Sleeping mind?
He gave me a puzzled look. That's what Elodin calls the part of us that knows names, I explained.
Dahl shrugged and ran a hand over his short black beard. Call it what you will. The fact that you heard me say anything is probably a good sign.
I don't know why I'm bothering with naming sometimes, I groused. I could have lit that brazier with sympathy.
Not without a link, Dahl pointed out.
Without a binding, a source of energy. It still seems pointless, I said. I learn things every day in your class, useful things. I don't have a thing to show for all the time I've spent on naming. Yesterday, you know what Elodin lectured about?
Dahl shook his head.
The difference between being naked and being nude, I said flatly. Dahl burst into laughter. I'm serious. I fought to be in his class, but now all I can do is think about all the time I'm wasting there, time I could be spending on more practical things.
There are things more practical than names, Dahl admitted. But watch. He focused on the brazier in front of us again. Then his eyes grew distant. He spoke again, whispering this time, then slowly lowered his hand until it was inches above the hot coals. Then, with an intent expression on his face, Dahl pressed his hand deep into the heart of the fire, nestling his spread fingers into the orange coals as if they were nothing more than loose gravel. I realized I was holding my breath and let it out softly, not wanting to break his concentration.
Ow!
Names, Dahl said firmly, and drew his hand back out of the fire. It was smudged with white ash, but perfectly unharmed. Names reflect true understanding of a thing. And when you truly understand a thing, you have power over it.
But fire isn't a thing unto itself, I protested. It's merely an exothermal chemical reaction.
I spluttered to a stop. Dahl drew in a breath, and for a moment it looked as if he would explain. Then he laughed instead, shrugging helplessly.
I don't have the wit to explain it to you. Ask Elodin. He's the one who claims to understand these things. I just work here.
After Dahl's class, I made my way over the river to Imre. I didn't find Denna at the inn where she was staying, so I headed to the Aeolian, despite the fact that I knew it was too early to find her there. There were barely a dozen people inside, but I did see a familiar face at the far end of the bar talking to Stanchion. Count Threp waved, and I walked over to join them.
"Quoth, my boy," Threp said enthusiastically, "I haven't seen you in a mortal age."
"Things have been rather hectic on the other side of the river," I said, setting down my loot case. Stanchion looked me over.
"You look it," he said frankly. "You look pale. You should get more red meat. Or sleep."
He pointed to a nearby stool.
"Barring that, I'll stand you a mug of metheglin."
"I'll thank you for that," I said, climbing onto a stool. It felt wonderful to take the weight off my aching legs.
"If it's meat and sleep you need," Threp said ingratiatingly, "you should come to dinner at my estate. I promise wonderful food and conversation so dull you can drowse straight through it and not worry about missing a thing."
He gave me an imploring look.
"Come now. I'll beg if I must. It won't be more than 10 people. I've been dying to show you off for months now."
I picked up the mug of metheglin and looked at Threp. His velvet jacket was a royal blue, and his suede boots were dyed to match. I couldn't show up for a formal dinner at his home dressed in second-hand road clothes, which were the only sort I owned. There was nothing ostentatious about Threp, but he was a noble born and raised. It probably didn't even occur to him that I didn't have any fine clothes. I didn't blame him for assuming that. The vast majority of the students at the university were at least modestly wealthy. How else could they afford tuition? The truth was, I'd like nothing better than a fine dinner and the chance to interact with some of the local nobility. I'd love to banter over drinks, repair some of the damage Ambrose had done to my reputation, and maybe catch the eye of a potential patron. But I simply couldn't afford the price of admission. A suit of passably fine clothes would cost at least a talent and a half, even if I bought them from a fripperer. Clothes do not make the man, but you need the proper costume if you want to play the part. Sitting behind Threp, Stanchion made an exaggerated nodding motion with his head.
"I'd love to come to dinner," I said to Threp. "I promise, just as soon as things settle down a bit over at the university."
"Excellent," Threp said enthusiastically. "I'm going to hold you to it, too. No backing out. I'll get you a patron, my boy. A proper one, I swear it."
Behind him, Stanchion nodded approvingly. I smiled at both of them and took another drink of metheglin. I glanced at the stairway to the second tier. Stanchion saw my look.
"She's not here," he said apologetically. "Haven't seen her in a couple days, actually."
A handful of people came through the door of the Aeolian and shouted something in Yilish. Stanchion waved at them and got to his feet.
"Duty calls," he said, wandering off to greet them.
"Speaking of patrons,"
I said to Threp. There's something I've been wanting to ask your opinion about. I lowered my voice. Something I'd rather you kept between the two of us. Threp's eyes glittered curiously as he leaned close. I took another drink of metheglin while I gathered my thoughts. The drink was hitting me more quickly than I'd expected. It was quite nice, actually, as it dulled the ache of my many injuries. I'm guessing you know most every potential patron within 100 miles of here. Threp shrugged, not bothering with false modesty.
A fair number. Everyone who's earnest about it. Everyone with money, anyway.
I have a friend, I said. A musician who is just starting out. She has natural talent, but not much training. Someone has approached her with an offer of help and a promise of eventual patronage. I trailed off, not sure how to explain the rest. Threp nodded.
You want to know if he's a legitimate sort, he said. Reasonable concern. Some folk feel a patron has a right to more than music.
He gestured to Stanchion.
If you want stories, ask him about the time the Duchess Samista came here on holiday.
He gave a chuckle that was almost a moan, rubbing at his eyes.
Tiny gods help me, that woman was terrifying.
That's my worry, I said. I don't know if he's trustworthy.
I can ask around if you like, Threp said. What's his name?
That's part of the issue, I said. I don't know his name. I don't think she knows it either. Threp frowned at this.
How can she not know his name?
He gave her a name, I said, but she doesn't know if it's real. Apparently he's particular about his privacy and gave her strict instructions never to tell anyone about him, I said. They never meet in the same place twice, never in public. He's gone for months at a time. I looked up at Threp. How does that sound to you?
Well, it's hardly ideal, Threp said, disapproval heavy in his voice. There's every chance this fellow isn't a proper patron at all. It sounds like he might be taking advantage of your friend.
I nodded glumly. That was my thought, too.
Then again, Threp said, some patrons do work in secret. If they find someone with talent, it's not unknown for them to nurture them in private, and then, he made a dramatic flourish with one hand, it's like a magic trick. You suddenly produce a brilliant musician out of thin air.
Threp gave me a fond smile.
I thought that's what someone had done with you, he admitted. You came out of nowhere and got your pipes. I thought someone had been keeping you hidden away until you were ready to make your grand appearance.
I hadn't thought of that, I said.
It does happen, Threp said. But strange meeting places and the fact that she's not sure of his name...
He shook his head, frowning.
If nothing else, it's rather indecorous. Either this fellow is having a bit of fun pretending to be an outlaw, or he's genuinely dodgy.
Threp seemed to think for a moment, tapping his fingers on the bar.
Tell your friend to be careful and keep her wits about her. It's a terrible thing when a patron takes advantage of a woman. That's a betrayal. But I've known men who did little but pose as patrons to gain a woman's trust.
He frowned.
That's worse.
I was halfway back to the university, with Stonebridge just beginning to loom in the distance, when I began to feel an unpleasant prickling heat run up my arm. At first, I thought it was the pain of the twice-stitched cuts on my elbow, as they'd been itching and burning all day. But instead of fading, the heat continued to spread up my arm and along the left side of my chest. I began to sweat, as if from a sudden fever. I stripped off my cloak, letting the chill air cool me, and began to unbutton my shirt. The autumn breeze helped, and I fanned myself with my cloak. But the heat grew more intense, painful even, as if I'd spilled boiling water across my chest. Luckily, this section of road ran parallel to a stream that fed into the nearby Omethi River. Unable to think of a better plan, I kicked off my boots, unshouldered my lute, and jumped into the water. The chill of the stream made me gasp and sputter, but it cooled my burning skin. I stayed there, trying not to feel like an idiot while a young couple walked past, holding hands and pointedly ignoring me. The strange heat moved through my body, like there was a fire inside me trying to find a way out. It started along my left side, then wandered down to my legs, then back up to my left arm. When it moved to my head, I ducked underwater. It stopped after a few minutes, and I climbed out of the stream. Shivering, I wrapped myself in my cloak, glad no one else was on the road. Then, since there was nothing else to do, I shouldered my loot case and began the long walk back to the university, dripping wet and terribly afraid. Chapter 23. Principles. I did tell Mola, I said as I shuffled the cards. She said it was all in my head and pushed me out the door. Well, I can only guess what that feels like, Sim said bitterly. I looked up, surprised by the uncharacteristic sharpness in his voice. But before I could ask what was the matter, Willem caught my eye and shook his head, warning me away. Knowing Sim's history, I guessed it was another quick, painful end to another quick, painful relationship. I kept my mouth shut and dealt another hand of breath. The three of us were killing time, waiting for the room to fill up before I started playing for my typical felling night crowd at Anchors.
"What do you think is the matter?" Willem asked.
I hesitated, worried that if I spoke my fears aloud, it might somehow make them true. I might have exposed myself to something dangerous in the fishery. Will looked at me.
"Such as?"
"Some of the compounds we use," I said. "They'll go straight through your skin and kill you in 18 slow ways." I thought back to the day my tendon glass had cracked in the fishery, of the single drop of transporting agent that had landed on my shirt. It was only a tiny drop, barely larger than the head of a nail. I was so certain it hadn't touched my skin. I hope that's not it, but I don't know what else it might be. It could be a lingering effect from the plumb bob, Sim said grimly. Ambrose isn't much of an alchemist, and from what I understand, one of the main ingredients is lead. If he factored it himself, some latent principles could be affecting your system. Did you eat or drink anything different today? I thought about it. I had a fair bit of metheglin at the Aeolian, I admitted.
That stuff will make anyone ill, Will said darkly.
I like it, Sim said. But it's practically a nostrum all by itself. There's a lot of different tincturing going on in there. Nothing alchemical, but you've got nutmeg, thyme, clove, all manner of spices. Could be that one of them triggered some of the free principles lurking in your system. Wonderful, I grumbled. And how do I go about fixing that, exactly? Sim spread his hands helplessly. That's what I thought, I said. Still, it sounds better than metal poisoning. Simon proceeded to take four tricks in a row with a clever card force, and by the end of the hand, he was smiling again. Sim was never really given to extended brooding. Will squared his cards away, and I pushed my chair back from the table. "Play the one about the drunk cow and the butter churn," Sim said. I couldn't help but crack a smile. "Maybe later," I said, as I picked up my increasingly shabby loot case and made my way to the hearth amid the sound of scattered, familiar applause. It took me a long moment to open the case, untwisting the copper wire I was still using in place of a buckle. For the next 2 hours, I played. I sang Copper Bottom Pot, Lilac Bough, and Aunt Emmy's Tub. The audience laughed and clapped and cheered. As I fingered my way through the songs, I felt my worries slough away. My music has always been the best remedy for my dark moods. As I sang, even my bruises seemed to pain me less. Then I felt a chill, as if a strong winter wind was blowing down the chimney behind me. I fought off a shiver and finished the last verse of Applejack, which I'd finally played to keep Sim happy. When I struck the last chord, the crowd applauded and conversation slowly welled up to fill the room again. I looked behind me at the fireplace, but the fire was burning cheerfully with no sign of a draft. I stepped down off the hearth, hoping a little walk would chase my chill away. But as soon as I took a few steps, I realized that wasn't the case. The cold settled straight into my bones. I turned back to the fireplace, spreading my hands to warm them. Will and Sim appeared at my side. "What's going on?" Sim asked. You look like you're going to be sick.
Something like that, I said, clenching my teeth to keep them from chattering. Go tell Anchor.